But in general terms, we can see that God is calling his people to take things that he's entrusted to them and use them for his glory. That's the kind of the big picture. God gives us opportunities, he gives us things, and then he looks to us to respond to him with those things that we are the stewards of, to bring glory and praise to his name through these things. If we go back to chapter 35, as we see from verse 30, that's why I started the reading there. Sorry, this is a bit awkward in my throat. Things that he's entrusted people with. He's entrusted people with skills. He's skilled and enabled people, made each of us different with our own gifts. And then those people that he has given the gifts to, he's then entrusted them with the materials they need to do the work that he's calling them to do. So he supplies the materials for the work that he's equipped these people to do. And it made me think, really, that what we're seeing here in the book of Exodus has a pattern, is a pattern of God's dealings with people going right the way through history. Goes right back to the garden. Do you remember what happened at the very beginning? If we're looking in Genesis chapter 1, at the beginning of the creation, we read that God made everything. God made the heavens and the earth. It's so clear, isn't it? There's the statement. God made the heavens and the earth. That contains everything. All that is, God made it. And not only did he make it, he made it in such a way that it pleased him. Do you remember the statement that we hear repeated through Genesis chapter 1? It was good. He saw it and it was good. He saw it and it was good. He saw it and it was good. And do you remember what he said when he created mankind? Very good. Very good. He's pleased with what he's made. He's made it all and he's made it to please him. He delights in everything that he's made. Everything that he's made is good or excellent. That's our God. He doesn't do anything by half measures. And we can appreciate that, can't we? As we look around and we see it all, we can appreciate how good it all is and how great our God must be to have made these things the way that he has. And obviously the slideshow that I showed you earlier was to try to illustrate just some of the things, just some of the wonderful things. Who'd have thought those little flowers, those little flax flowers growing in the field could be taken and used and produced in such a way to make fine linens? Who'd have thought that that little pink flower, the indigo flower, could make these beautiful blue colours, these vibrant blues? And who'd have thought that little beetle, the cochineal beetle, would yield up to a scarlet? Anybody wearing a red jumper today, you know? You know that the origin of these things is in such, God has invested our world with treasure, hasn't he? This is a world full of treasures. It really is. The Murex. Who discovered that the Murex mollusk was able to yield up that purple? What a discovery. The things that we find in this world. That sea cow. I remember as a kid, the first time I saw a picture of a sea cow. I don't know why. It's really stuck in my mind. At school and in the atlases, you see lots of different creatures, don't you? And then to see this, and I just thought, I never even knew such a thing existed. What an amazing creature this is. And when you see these nature programs and you see all the different things that God has made, it fills your heart, doesn't it? And that we can do such extraordinary things with the raw materials that are provided here, like cashmere. Who'd have thought a cashmere coat came off the back of a woolly goat? You'd never have thought it, would it? But, you know, somebody worked it all out and God gave them the skills and the insight and the knowledge and the understanding to use all the things that he has made, the copper and the tin and the leather and the wood and the silver. And clearly, in the beginning, he made everything for his glory, didn't he? He made the whole world for his glory. And these particular things that we've been reading about in chapter 36, 8 through to 38, those things mentioned there in the list there, were made for his glory. He particularly put his hand on those things because he wanted those things for a particular work that he was doing in the world for his glory. Now, a lot of people are very I don't know how to best to express it, but troubled by the world that they see looking around. We, you know, this is a good world made by a good God. It's full of good things, and we have been enabled to do so many extraordinary things and given so many amazing abilities. There's no two ways about it. And yet we look around at the world that we've made, and without sort of putting a dampener on everything, the fact is that there is, we see so much abuse and ruin in this world too, don't we? I remember watching this program about the Amazon, and the number of species that are being made extinct as they're doing the deforestation in the Amazon at the moment is so fast. The extinction rate is so fast. They don't know what the species is that has been made extinct until after it's become extinct. And species around the world are just disappearing around the world before we're even able to find them and catalogue them. And you only have to look at those photographs of the sort of devastation of those mountains. I know there's plans afoot and man's got to be fed and all these sort of things, but you just look at it all and it just makes your heart bleed when there's sort of the quarries and they've just ripped the face of a mountain off. And it somehow you can't help but just sort of feel, on the one hand, isn't God good that he's provided all these things that we need? But at the same time, there seems to be such a heavy cost. A heavy cost. The world seems to be groaning. And all the wars that we've fought over these things so that we can have the gold and other people can have the silver or the steel and all the things that the squabbles. And you only have to look at there's going to be next year, 2014, we've got the anniversary, a centenary since the First World War began. And perhaps you've seen the photographs of the devastation of the Somme and the mud, the mire, the mess of it all. It breaks your heart, doesn't it? This beautiful world that God's made, why does it have to be that it has to suffer so and effectively at our hands? But having said all that, isn't it wonderful that despite all that, there's still so much good in the world? Look out the window for a minute. Just look at the color of the sky. Look at the color of the sky. The sky is still an amazing blue outside our windows. Isn't it wonderful? Despite everything that's going on, he still keeps, there's so much goodness. God has done such wonderful things. It's almost, you know, impossible for us to completely obscure it. The goodness of God just keeps singing out, doesn't it? And speaking out. His greatness keeps speaking out through it all. When God made all these things, to whom did they belong? If you make something and to who does he owe these things? Where do all the things come from? Did he borrow it from somebody and put it together? He made it all, didn't he? It's his. It's all his. And even though the world is not what it was when it was made, it's still his, isn't it? And all the goodness and everything that's right and good in this world is still his, isn't it? He is the earth is the Lord's, write the psalmist. And do you remember what the next line is? And the fullness thereof. Everything in it. It belongs to God. It's all God's. And it's all made for his glory, isn't it? It's all made for his glory. And that includes you. Do you remember what we're saying about Genesis chapter 1? It is good. It is good. It is good. It is very good. You're his treasure. People are his treasure. The pinnacle of the creation. Made for his glory. Above everything else, made for his glory. And that special place that we have in the world is a great responsibility as well, isn't it? We've got a great call on our life. From the beginning, what did God say to us? He said, you have dominion over the whole earth. He gave us the responsibility for this planet, for the world in which we live. He gave us a unique place, a unique responsibility. Do we now own the world because we've been given this responsibility? Some people act as if they do. But nobody owns it. God, it belongs to God, doesn't it? Belongs to God. So what's the very, very best we can say about anything we have in our possession? That we're the stewards of these things, yes? That we've been entrusted with these things. We can say, in one sense, they're ours. You know, we can use that as a term, but we shouldn't let that term so go to our heads as we come to believe it to mean something which it doesn't mean. They are on temporary loan to you for your use, but the purpose of that use is that you might glorify God with these things that you've been entrusted with. That's the responsibility of the stewardship that we have been given. It's been made according to his will, and it's to be used according to his will. Do you agree? Yes? Do you agree? On Friday night, Phil and I and various others were here, and the young people were here. We had the young people's group, the Toast group, and we have 15 minutes thereabouts usually talking to the young people. And we sat down and we were talking about this whole thing about how we've been on this subject, really, wasn't it? That we've been entrusted with this world and we haven't really kept that trust terribly well. One of the little lads here just said, if the consequences of our misuse of the world and our relationships and all these sort of things will keep us out of heaven, he said something like, I think heaven's going to be pretty empty. He was really concerned because he sees the way that people really handle the things, and nobody fulfills their responsibilities perfectly, and if we have to do it perfectly and that will keep us out of heaven if we don't, he said, I think heaven's going to be pretty empty. And he's quite concerned about it all. But they started to throw some quite serious questions our way, didn't they? That evening, they started to talk to us and probe us, because a number of them, they don't necessarily believe in God. They're not sure whether there is a God or not. People who they've known and trusted in their life have been bringing them up, whether they're school teachers or parents, haven't been teaching them that there is a God necessarily, and they're not sure whether they believe it. So they naturally, rightfully start asking us questions about this sort of thing, and they were pushing us and probing us, and they were asking questions that were a little bit like this. Why has God, who's made the world as beautiful and excellent as he is, entrusted all these things to us, knowing what we're like, knowing that we would not fulfill our responsibilities in the way that would please him? Why has he done that? You know, is it his will that we should take some of the chemicals and the amazing things and use them and combine them together and make chemical weapons to wipe each other out? Is that God's will? Is that what he wants with all these things that he's made? Does he delight in these sort of things? Why has he entrusted us with these things when he can see what we, and must have known what sort of things we'd do with them? Or is God so weak that actually he's given these all, like a weak sort of, he's given them all to you, and then when we're not using them properly, oh, I can't do anything about it, you know, because they're all running a riot. Is that what God's like? Is he unwise? Is he not powerful? Why is the world the way it is? Why has God set the world up in such a way that it could become the way it has? If God cares, which is the real message we wanted to get across to them, wasn't it? That God cares for them. If God cares, why does it seem like he allows evil at very, very least? Or possibly, as far as they're concerned, even command evil? Why? That's the sort of probing they were doing. Because the truth is that when we abuse what God has given us and don't use it for his glory and for his praise, we're abusing him, aren't we? It's an insult to him who made all things, to the actual owner of these things. We're doing these things in his face. Why has he allowed these things to be the way they have? Why did God give us dominion over all the earth, knowing what people would do? Did he just stand by? Has he just stood by and let us do all these things and hasn't got the power or the wisdom to have foreseen and being able to do anything about it? These are quite searching questions, aren't they, these young people are asking? Is that a fair rendition of the general line of argument? These are 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds. A philosophical discussion on free will. Not bad. I think the thing that they found, they're really trying to come to terms with, and they can't yet fathom out yet, is that it's not just that we've taken the world from God and using it as we please. He's given it to us. He's given it to us. And that's an amazing thing, knowing what we're like, that he's given it to us. And more than that, somebody else, I read this on the internet, said, God has come so close to us. How close has God come to us? He said, God has come so close to us that he's allowed us opportunity to kill him. He gave us his only begotten son. God has come so close to us. You know, imagine he could have kept himself just at a distance, just out of reach. But he didn't. He let us put our hands on Jesus. He let us take him to trial. He let us beat him and treat him the way we did and despise and reject him. He let us take him to Calvary and there crucify him. He let his son Jesus Christ die on the cross and be buried in the grave. God gave us this world knowing what we're like. He gave us his son knowing what we're like. Why did God keep loving and giving to us? Is this a mad plan? Or is this God wiser and more glorious than at this time they seem to be able to fully take in and understand? Has he just written out, has he taken out his checkbook and put a blank check to the human race and said, go and do what you like. Go and sin. Is that what God has done? So that we can just do whatever we like without consequences? No. No, he hasn't. No, that is not how it is. Not at all. You know, people are breaking the law. As we're speaking, sitting here quietly in this room, there's somebody out there breaking the law, isn't there? Right? Does that make it all right? Just because it's possible to break the law, does it mean it's all right to break the law? Does it mean there'll be no consequences for them, for what they've done? Is that the case? What about freedom of speech? We have freedom of speech in this country. Does that mean that people therefore have the right, this has been in the press rather a lot recently, hasn't it? Do people therefore have the right to use freedom of speech to express their hatred, to abuse one another, to lie? Is that what the freedom of speech is all about? I don't think so. I think freedom of speech is given to us so we can speak the truth, isn't it? So we can tell the truth and build each other up. And society can be built and used properly without fear that we won't be able to speak the truth. That's what these things are all about. So the fact that people abuse what is good does not mean that it is condoned or right. You know, the things that we do wrong, they have their consequences. If you get caught in the speed camera, you will get a fine. If you break the speed limit, you will get a fine one of these days. And people will say, well, but people get away with so much. Have you noticed that? People get away with so much. I was talking to a father the other day, and he was saying to me, why is it? Tell me why it is that the man who punched my son and knocked him to the ground so he smashed his head, that has left him paralyzed and in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, why is the man who did this going to get out of prison years before my son will even come out of hospital? Why? Does this seem unfair? Does it seem that the consequences of doing wrong are not far-reaching enough? That people seemingly get away with doing terrible things in this world without being brought to book, without being brought to justice. And even when they do finally get caught and tried and face the penalty for what they've done, that somehow the punishment never really fully fits the crimes. There is something that some people have done that we cannot dream up a punishment. We cannot dream up a sentence. The man Breivik in Norway, for example, he's going down for maybe 20 years after killing 70-something. How can we say that the punishment fits the crime? It seems that he's just going to spend the next 20 years in a comfortable cell, relatively. It's not enough. It seems it's not enough. But this book, this Bible that we have in front of us tells us that consequences of what we do don't just affect us in this world. They have lasting effects into eternity. And really, I am so thankful that we don't actually get what we deserve in this world. Because I'm persuaded when we read the Bible about heaven and hell, that hell is truly exactly what it says. It is hell. You know, we hear people making mockery and making light of it. Hell is hell. That's why it's called hell. Because that's just what it is. It is hell. And heaven truly is what it says it is. It is heaven. Heaven. And I'm glad that in this world, in one sense, shape or form, we don't face the full penalty for what we have, because we have an opportunity while we live and breathe to come to God, to find God, because we've been given so much, we've been entrusted with so much, which is supposed to be used for God's glory. And we fail, all of us, in so many ways and shapes and form, that we have been given some opportunity. We know enough of the consequences of it in this world to know that what we do is wrong. And to awaken our consciences enough to know that we need to come to God and face the judgment that would be rightfully ours. Because we have opportunity in this world to get things right with God here and now. But once we go in the world to come, there is no more time for repenting. There's no more time for changing of your mind. You live with the consequences of what you've done forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Marjorie, you know, recently she just the finality of life. Suddenly, you know, Marjorie's husband died in an instant. He died in an instant. A lad up in Bradford the other day, 16, 17 year old, he just didn't wake up one morning. This isn't to scare people. These things happen in this world to alert us. To alert us to the potential and the possibility that even if that something like that doesn't happen to us, and please God that all of us will have good long lives and be fully ready and prepared for the day when it comes. But we must be ready. We must be ready. And we've got to prepare our hearts. We've got to get right with God. We've got to admit the fact that we've fallen short and seek his face and get a right heart and repent of our sins and seek forgiveness for all these things and get a right relationship with God. It's so urgent. It's so important. I'm saying all these things. I mean, I wouldn't blame somebody here who's sort of thinking to themselves, well, what has this got to do with Exodus chapter 36? What has this got to do with it? But it's about the fact that they were given work to do. They were entrusted, just like in the garden, they were given work to do. They were given work to do. God blessed them and gave them all these opportunities to do something for him. And what we're reading in chapter 36 here is how we see how hearts should be. When God gives skills and abilities, they were ready to use them for the Lord. That's how we are. That's a picture of a man in right relationship with God, using the things that God has given him, using it for God's glory. Everything we do, actually, and according to the standard of God, is to be used to love God and to love our neighbours as ourselves. That is the standard and the pattern for life. And the truth is, there is so much that we have and so much that we've got that we does not get used that way. I feel so moved when I read these chapters, because I know that Israel's history was not always like this, but at this particular time in their history, the way the Lord just moved in their heart, chapter 36, you can just see that Bezalel al-Halib, the skilled person to whom the Lord, he'd given these skills to know how to carry out the work and construct the sanctuary and the work, just as the Lord commanded. He gave him a heart to obey, to use his skills, to use his talents, to use his time, to use the things he'd been entrusted with for God's glory. And the most precious thing of all, I think, he had, and the most precious thing that we all need, it's the last of those things. It's not, yes, we need skill, yes, we need ability, yes, we need knowledge, yes, we need material things. But this man was given by God the most precious thing of all, a right heart. A heart that wanted to yield up his talents, yield up his gifts, serve God. That's the most precious thing of all, isn't it? Because I think of all the things we looked up on the screen, the silver and the gold and all the rest of it, there isn't that much gold in the world. There isn't that much platinum. I know there's lots of rare things. I would say probably one of the rarest things in the whole wide world is to find somebody whose heart is for the Lord. There is nearly 7 billion people in the world. How many people have got a heart for God? How many people are living for God, giving their heart and soul to God and using their talents and their opportunities for the glory of God? I don't know, but the Lord knows. And there are times where we read in the Bible, my eyes run all through the earth looking for somebody whose heart is for me. You know, God is looking for a people for himself. And at this point in Israel's history, God by his Spirit was giving such a heart to people and they were serving him. You know the people who've got the silver, they've got the gold, they've got the talent, they've got the education. You know the people, don't you? They've got it all. But they haven't got a heart for God. They're keeping it all to themselves. They're spending it on other things. What profits a man if he gains the whole world, but he loses his own soul? He has no fellowship with God at all. All these things that has been entrusted to them and yet not used for his glory. The Egyptian people who the children of Israel were escaping from. Yeah, they were a great, great people. A great people. Talented, skilled people. Has anybody been to the museums and gone and seen some of the Egyptian artifacts and the artworks and stuff like that? Some of the finest artwork ever made in the history of the world. But they used all that gold and they used all that wood and they used all that talent and they spent it on things which aren't God at all, fearing men who God has made. You only have to look at Genesis chapter 1 and see all the things. They worship the sun, they worship the moon, they worship the stars, they worship the animals, they worship the birds, they worship men, they worship the creation. And the Bible says, chapter 1 of God made all those things. Why would you want to worship the creation when you could worship the one who made all these things, even God? So I don't know what God has given you, but I know that when I have given anything by God and I give it to him in his service, there is such a joy and a delight in doing that. There's a peace. That's fellowship, isn't it? Your life given to God, giving your life to God, giving your heart to the Lord. There is joy in that because there's fellowship with God in that. From verse 2 through to verse 7 there, the people discovered this joy for themselves, didn't they? They discovered the joy of serving the Lord. And they just gave and they gave and they gave and they gave and they just kept giving. They kept giving so much that in the end they had to say, stop, enough, no more. Because they learned what it is to delight in the Lord and to live for God and not to hold back. They knew what God wanted and they realized that he'd given it to them and they gave it back to him. And so this great tent that we saw the picture of there, out of nothing it appeared. It all came together. It was all finished. It was all built. It was all made. The Lord provides wonderfully for his own work. He wanted the thing built. He gave the heart and it came together. And that's the way the Lord works. He works through people's hearts, doesn't he? Not just the physical things that we need, but the spiritual provision we need. We need a right heart. Looking at the time. I don't know what moved their hearts. I don't know if they felt guilty because of the incident of the golden calf that had just happened and they were stung. They realized they'd fallen short and they wanted to put things right. I don't know if it's because God forgave them for these things. They were so thankful that he was so gracious with them. I don't know if it's because they remembered what he did for them in Egypt and they realized that they've got a God who saves them and loves them. But whatever it is, we know from chapter 35:21, whatever they did, all these gifts they gave them from the heart. The Lord was working in their hearts. And that is the work of God, isn't it? And somehow in this, I can see that the circle is closed. God gave human beings the opportunity, the freedom to go their own way. But it means so much more when his consistent love for them finally wears them down, overwhelms them. They realize who he is and what he's like and how great is his love, that they stop and they turn and they come back to him and they give themselves to him with all of their hearts. And he has now won them for himself. They're his out from their hearts. And he has fellowship with people. It doesn't matter how many, but there are people in the earth with whom he has real fellowship. It's a wonderful thing. I'm going to draw things to a close. We're not building a tent, are we, here? That's not our work. And they did what God called them to do. We've got to do what God is calling us to do. And we've got to make a sanctuary in this world where people can know God too. We've got to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's our work, isn't it, really? To make Christ known so that people can come in. That's the place of worship, the place of meeting. That's our work, isn't it? Oh, all the work on the building, that's kind of, in one sense, this is just the material stuff that helps us to support, to do the work, the real work that we've got to do, which is making Christ known. And that's a heart work, isn't it? We need to be given the heart by God to do it. And he does supply for us. And everything else we do, we just do it with all of our hearts as working to the Lord, not to men, since we know we'll receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It's the Lord Christ that you are serving. We're going to close with a couple of, with just one final song this morning, and that's this. When I survey the wondrous cross. See, that all the things that he was calling them to do and that they did spoke of Christ. And Christ has come now. And you've seen him. You've heard of Jesus. You've heard of what he's done. You've heard of the gift that he's given, even his own life. And you know the part that you've got to play. You know the gifts that God has given you to proclaim Christ and to make him known and to build up fellowship here and everywhere and to pray and all the things that God has called you to do. And when the Lord gets a hold of our hearts and we give ourselves to his work, when we do what the hymn writer says, when our riches gain, we count but loss. We've got all this stuff, but it doesn't mean anything without him. We just want to spend our lives on him. We want to give ourselves to him. We pour contempt on what we can do for ourselves. And all we want to do is, like these people of old, our brothers and sisters of those, in those times, is just to lift up the name of the Lord.